and welcome to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. Donald Trump has returned to the White House, and since then, drastic changes have manifested as a very clear effort to reorder the U.S. government takes shape. Many Trump supporters are elated, arguing that true change has come, that corruption and fraud are being rooted out, and that the quote-unquote deep state is being dismantled before our eyes. While a dismantling of government infrastructure, some more controversial than others, is certainly happening, few of the cheerleaders are taking the time to consider what may be erected in its place and if it will really manifest in something better than the previous system. Part of the reason for this disinterest, perhaps, lies in the celebrity status of many in the big tech clique that is shaping this demolition of old structures and the erecting of new ones. That clique, often referred to as the PayPal Mafia, have carefully crafted a public image of libertarianism, with a few exceptions, and through their significant patronage of so-called independent media, have successfully manufactured trust among many longtime and also recent Trump voters, with some calling these former PayPal employees, quote-unquote, our elites. Behind this carefully crafted image lies something different, however. From CIA-linked companies like Palantir expanding their role at the core of the mass surveillance state, to the PayPal Mafia's longstanding ambition to create a quote-unquote new world currency, many of the same policies that once recently incensed the right are slated to now be implemented by this faction of big tech who have cloaked themselves in free market and America first rhetoric. To explore this reality, the Unlimited Hangout podcast is beginning its first ever series entitled The PayPal Presidency, to explore the way in which the PayPal Mafia is molding government policy as well as some of the often overlooked ambitions of its members. In this first installment, we will look at this group's ambitions for healthcare and biotechnology. Many Trump voters this cycle embrace the quote-unquote Make America Healthy Again or MAHA movement, which initially supported a rejection of the experimental biotech products rolled out during the COVID era, as well as a desire to extricate government healthcare regulation from the pharmaceutical industry. While it appears that MAHA's de facto champion, Robert F. Kennedy, is slated to become of HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, the department is poised to approve a slate of experimental products via deregulation to introduce biosurveillance regimes that would result in mass biodata mining and to expand Palantir's already massive and invasive contracts with HHS. Joining me to discuss this and more is Max Jones, who has written and co-written several recent Unlimited Hangout investigations covering these very topics. In addition to contributing to Unlimited Hangout, Max is the producer for Chris Hedges' The Chris Hedges Report and a staff writer and video producer for Sheer Post. Thanks for joining me today, Max, and welcome to Unlimited Hangout.
Thanks for having me, Whitney.
Well, it is my pleasure. And I guess we could start off this discussion talking about the MAHA movement itself, how it was an important part of getting Trump elected, at least, you know, that's the perception anyway, and how a lot of the initially stated goals that injected a lot of energy into that movement have gradually been moved, largely since the Kennedy endorsement of Trump several months ago. So as I noted earlier, a lot of the initial focus of MAHA was around taking big pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, out of government healthcare regulation, ending the so-called revolving door, which was a big focus of Robert F. Kennedy's campaign and some of his work prior, and definitely something he voiced extensively on his podcast, and also a rejection of COVID-era policies, that including the military run Operation Warp Speed, initially launched during the first Trump administration, and also the experimental biotech products, namely the mRNA vaccines that were produced downstream of Operation Warp Speed, and became, you know, obviously a source of great controversy for a lot of people in this particular movement. But it seems like a lot of the MAHA ambitions, at least if you're following what the influencers in this movement are saying, seems to have changed. Have you noticed that as well?
Yeah, definitely. Because it's actually interesting, because I think that there's been this characterization of RFK Jr. on the liberal side of the spectrum as being like this insane right-wing nut job, even though he's a right-wing Democrat. And then there's this, a lot of people on the right or conservatives that were skeptical of COVID era policy really were drawn to him because of his critiques that I think he made in the book that he wrote, which were all very, a lot of it, which was very valid. And when you look at RFK's actual initial agenda that was then associated with Make America Healthy Again, it was built on this kind of like liberal promise to use regulatory power to curb the influence of big pharma and big food. And, you know, some of the things that, and in a pretty moderate way, I think that like in previous election cycles, if it was coming from a more traditional like Democratic Party figure that wasn't associated with conservatives via COVID, I'm guessing most liberals would probably support. Like one of the things that he wanted to do, aside from the increasing regulations and making the clinical trials for vaccines more rigorous, were things like stopping advertising on TV from Big Pharma, which is something that's like pretty widely accepted among the Democratic Party constituency, I believe. But, you know, partisan politics kind of brain rots everything. So there's this weird distortion with RFK. And so while RFK's initial agenda was built on this kind of promise to use regulatory power to curb the influence of these industries, there's been this shift. And that kind of grew out of, as we note in the article, out of the shuttering of his campaign and his association with Trump. And RFK's endorsement of Trump, in my opinion, was pretty important because the Trump campaign, I think, realized this time around that the populist element of Trump was what was going to give them the victory against the Democrats, which were very much associated with the establishment. And RFK kind of granted them this tinge of populism through his association with Trump. And now we see, just like recently with these hearings, RFK is starting to really back away from these initial promises to use regulatory power to do things like increase the rigorousness of clinical trials on vaccines and re-examining the childhood vaccine mandates. And like just one tidbit that I saw in the New York Times the other day that like shows this. So in order to move forward in his confirmation to lead HHS, RFK secured the endorsement of Senator Bill Cassidy. And Cassidy has obvious ties to big pharma and vaccine development. Like, so, and by the way that he secured this endorsement, according to the Times, was by extracting a series of commitments from Kennedy, Cassidy did. And Cassidy's largest donors are from pharma and healthcare companies. Like his second largest contributor was actually from Ochsner Health System. If I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but it's spelled O-C-H-S-N-E-R. And they actually, during the pandemic, increased insurance costs for their employees with unvaccinated spouses during the pandemic. And RFK allegedly promised this guy Cassidy that he was going to give Congress advance notice of any changes he might make in vaccine policy. So that, among other comments that RFK made, which you can describe for the audience, really show RFK shifting away from this initial agenda that I think really helped Trump cultivate a lot of those COVID era dissidents, despite being the government that actually initiated a lot of this policy, like Operation Warp Speed.
Yeah. So I think, you know, obviously there are the devil's advocates out there that say, well, of course, RFK had to say these things in front of the Senate. Otherwise, he can't be confirmed. But sort of that wishy-washiness as a means of obtaining political power, it opens up enough doubt that you can't really know if that's true or not. And if he's expressing, you know, the viewpoints he expressed there to the Senate, it's certainly possible that he plans to implement those policies stated there. Obviously, he'd experience a lot more resistance if he were to pursue stuff he said, you know, back when he was on the campaign trail, for example. But again, it remains to be seen, I think, to an extent with RFK as HHS secretary. But I think there have been some revealing statements even before and reports even before his confirmation hearing. So one of these was a Wall Street Journal article that's from January 14th. So almost a month ago. And it's entitled Trump Team Sidelines RFK Jr.'s Anti-Vaccine Aides. And essentially that article, citing people close to both Trump and Kennedy, says that Kennedy was in sort of dumping a lot of his people close to him that were expected to serve as aides if he were appointed to HHS, that he had affiliations with from Children's Health Defense, from example, in favor of, it seems like he didn't really pick his staff, actually. So one of these would be that his chief of staff is Heather Flick, who was picked by Trump, who was previously involved with Alex Azar's HHS, which was Trump's first term. And, you know, was the HHS that declared COVID a health emergency and oversaw a lot of the creation and implementation of Operation Warp Speed. before Biden came into office. There is a section in this article that basically, and I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially said something to the effect that he was going to not pursue changes to vaccine policy because instead was going to focus on wins and food and exercise. And it's interesting that that report came out when it did, because in the months prior to that, several influential figures, now influential figures, sort of seemed to come out of nowhere after the Kennedy endorsement of Trump, namely the Means siblings, Callie and Casey Means, and started promoting a lot of this, the stuff about sort of blaming the chronic disease epidemic, as it's been referred to, in which I agree with the nomenclature there, as being, you know, pretty much entirely due to big food, but only specific aspects of things in big food. I don't think biotech, GMOs in the food supply have been really addressed meaningfully by the Means siblings, but have sort of focused on the unhealthy standard American diet and sort of this promotion of things like beef tallow, among other things, which, you know, is fine. I'm certainly not criticizing those claims, but I think it's sort of an effort to engineer a more myopic stance for MAGA so that it's easier to secure those quote unquote wins for the movement and sort of act like campaign promises to that coalition were fulfilled while avoiding the ones that involve removing industry influence from HHS and the FDA, for example, and anything that would have to do with sort of taking mRNA products off the market or making it more difficult to get on the market.
Right. And another thing that I found interesting in that article was that they described Flick, according to a former FDA official, so I don't know exactly how accurate this claim is, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's true. And it seems to fit based on the moneyed interest in the that are associated with the Trump administration, that Flick is acting as the sort of, this is what they say, sort of Trump guy's eyes and ears within the department too. She's a very important liaison and information source, the chief of staff, they kind of lay down the law. So like that implies that there is this effort from within the Trump camp to basically subvert Kennedy's more radical agenda, I guess you could say.
And it sounds like a babysitter.
Yeah, exactly. And mm-hmm. and that makes, you know, that might be surprising to a lot of people that are, follow these like MAGA or MAGA influencers that kind of just don't really cover this stuff. But when you look at the people that are actually very heavily affiliated with Trump, it's not that surprising. Like, for example, the most obvious one is probably like Peter Thiel, who, is pretty much entirely responsible for the rise of J.D. Vance's entire political career and also started his private sector career in venture capital. And I mean, Peter Thiel is the founder and currently the largest shareholder of Palantir. And Palantir right now has multiple contracts with HHS and the CDC, which is a sub-agency of HHS, to basically build up this entire biosurveillance infrastructure across the country to basically feed data from the local level to the federal level, a steady stream of bio data to constantly develop pandemic and disease outbreak forecasts to then allow the CDC to correspondingly provide curated policy for communities based on their outbreak potential or outbreak status or whatever. And so obviously like something like that is very heavily associated with these mRNA, the procurement of mRNA and biotechnology products. As we saw during COVID-19, like you reported, I think initially in The Last America Vagabond, about how Google and Oracle were, according to, I think, one of the Operation Warp Speed heads, I don't know if this was actually, like if the contracts were ever officially.
Joseph Salawi, who was the head of Operation Warp Speed, said it, that Google and Oracle had received contracts to follow recipients of the COVID-19 mRNA vaccines for up to 2 years.
Right. Yeah. So biosurveillance is part and parcel to emergency procurement, development, and distribution of biotechnology products. So like right there, you have a clear example of how one of the key guys associated with Trump has made huge investments in this industry existing in the first place. So when you take note of that, it actually makes this whole effort to subvert Kennedy and this this incentive from Kennedy to, in order to secure the position, to like basically distance himself from his initial policy agenda, it actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, I think there's the potential also to do some sort of dynamic, some good cop, bad cop dynamic, at least in terms of public perception with HHS policy going forward. Considering, as we covered recently, the appointment to be the deputy to RFK, deputy HHS secretary being Jim O'Neill, who is a longtime Peter Thiel associate, used to run the Thiel Foundation, co-founded the Thiel Fellowship with Peter Thiel, worked at Mithril Capital and also Clarium Capital, which is now Thiel Capital. And obviously at Mithril, he was J.D. Vance's boss, I guess, where, you know, significant investments in biotech and also in Palantir were made. So Jim O'Neill, and as you can read our article on this for all the nitty gritty details, he essentially has been arguing for quite some time for the ending of efficacy testing of products at, I guess, the FDA specifically. He was actually floated to be FDA head under the first Trump administration and was considered too controversial for that role. And I can't remember if Balaji Srinivasan, who's the Andreessen Horowitz partner that created the network state idea, he was also pitched to be head of FDA, but was also deemed too controversial. And then they settled, I guess, on Scott Gottlieb, who became kind of infamous during the COVID era for his revolving door relationship with Pfizer. And also this CIA-linked company that's now doing all the biomanufacturing for this, a lot of the mRNA vaccines. It's called Resilience. I think previously was called National Resilience, that I reported on some a few years ago. But essentially, Jim O'Neill, by eliminating efficacy tests, would facilitate a lot of these products getting on the market, because as a lot of my past reporting and reporting of others has noted about these mRNA products and what was even known about them before the COVID-19 event. Basically, you can either make them safe but not effective, or toxic and effective. It's kind of like the slider where you either get one or the other. And that makes it, of course, very difficult for them to get through the existing regulatory paradigm at the FDA. Mm-hmm. And as we noted just a minute ago, a lot of what was the initial ambition, at least publicly expressed, of this MAHA movement was about more stringent clinical testing for these types of experimental products. Because, of course, a lot of the controversy around what happened during COVID-19 is that, you know, the emergency deregulatory paradigm was used to force this experimental biotech onto the market and onto the public. And basically the people that took it became guinea pigs. And this is when you can consider that for 10 years, Moderna and, you know, Pfizer's BioNTech, you know, they couldn't get anything on the market because right. They couldn't even get through animal trials. You know, all of a sudden they can get on the market and they're...
Well, yeah, like Moderna, as you reported in your Moderna in Need of a Hail Mary series, it actually suffered from a lot of the same problems that we note in our article, that the companies that O'Neill invests in via Mithril and also I think personally as well, suffers from, which is like they can't even get through or even get to clinical trials sometimes because of these problems, right? And like some of these companies that he's worked for have existed for like over a decade and they have no products brought to market, just like Moderna before the COVID-19 pandemic. And they were,
And so some of these companies have been around for like 15 years or longer in some cases, and haven't been able to get anything on the market. So obviously, the only way to get it on the market thus far has been to, you know, use COVID-19 vaccines because of, you know, the emergency use authorization. I would technically call it a loophole in this case, but it's really the only way that it's been able to go on the market. Obviously, it seems like the testing for livestock, you know, there's been a lot of talk about mRNA products already being with the livestock, I guess. There are cases where it does get through animal trials for animal vaccines, but I have a feeling that animal vaccine testing is a lot less stringent than it is for humans. And I don't know. Well, I'm kind of, I think it's interesting, this whole ending efficacy testing paradigm, because of course it's being framed as a way to remove needless regulation and bureaucratic red tape and to make way for free market innovation. And these are, you know, kind of the standard Republican talking points here. But obviously, what happened during COVID-19 was a removal, technically, right, of that bureaucratic red tape. And it sort of unleashed a very corrupt pharmaceutical industry, or wing of it, rather, in biotech, to have no liability for these experimental products and have them used massively and to reap massive profits from them. And of course, now that's been pitched as the U.S. government would share in those profits. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, in the press conference announcing the creation of a new U.S. sovereign wealth fund, commented how the U.S. would begin buying equity in these types of vaccine companies, so that when, you know, COVID-19 vaccines, for example, are sold abroad, the U.S. government has a direct financial incentive, which is pretty telling, I think, of where this administration plans to go with mRNA. And I think also some of the controversial statements made by Oracle's Larry Ellison at the Stargate press conference on Trump's first day in the White House about this new era of AI-powered, personalized mRNA vaccines for cancer. A lot of these mRNA companies that got, you know, sort of looked at by independent media during COVID, a lot of them have been focusing on cancer specifically for a long time, because you can basically charge more because you're making a personalized vaccine for each person. There's been a push for this. It was arguably one of the reasons that Biden created the ARPA-H, the Health DARPA agency, which he framed as a cancer moonshot. A lot of it was framed around this very same idea that is being promoted on day one of the Trump White House, which is quite telling.
And importantly, ARPA-H was, as you noted in your investigation, was initially pitched to the Trump administration as a pre-crime tool. And a lot of, I don't think that there was any, when they transitioned to a predictive health program, it wasn't like they changed the data sources that they would be tapping under this program for pre-health purposes versus
or even the architect. I mean, one of the, so the main guy behind it is this guy named Bob Wright, who is the top executive at NBC Universal. And he's a good friend of Trump, because that is the, you know, the network that brought you the Apprentice. But it was the main architect that was hired by Wright to design the program as an ex-DARPA guy named Jeffrey Ling, who was basically running a lot of the experimental biotech stuff at DARPA. Because initially, a lot of this mRNA technology came out of DARPA funding, a lot of it happening under the Obama administration, their DARPA. Mm-hmm. And since then, the head of the director of DARPA when those initial investments in mRNA were made is Regina Dugan. And she has since become head of the Wellcome Trust's own DARPA equivalent called Wellcome Leap that I reported on a few years ago. So, it's notable, I think, that this is set to expand in the U.S. under the current administration, because a lot of the same entities that were vilified during COVID, and I think were rightly vilified personally, whether that's the Wellcome Trust or, Bill Gates and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, are all in on biotech and really see it as necessary to expand, their ambitions for global health and, the health related sustainable development goals, which I've argued, in my work on the SDGs, is really about creating new markets and using public policy to impose those markets on people, because there's no actual demand for the products of these markets that they're making. And that kind of, I think maybe kind of similar to what ends up happening here, it's ultimately, maybe the sales pitches are different, or the way it's being marketed is going to be different, under Trump. But ultimately, having this type of experimental biotechnology be all over the market and its use be normalized, I think is definitely something that we can expect over the next 4 years, unfortunately. And I think another indicator of this, in addition to sort of these quote unquote babysitters that are actually going to be running the show for RFK. You know, he's nominally the head, but Heather Flick, as chief of staff, decides who gets access to him, what his schedule is, what he does as HHS secretary, basically. And then Jim O'Neill being basically the person who manages day-to-day operations and oversees the FDA and all these sub-agencies on Kennedy's behalf. There is a lot of room to go against Kennedy, even if Kennedy was intent on challenging biotech as head of HHS. And as you noted earlier, it's not necessarily clear that is the case. But I don't want to come out and say it's not a possibility. But, you know, right. I'm not very enthusiastic about the prospects at the moment, but I don't want to necessarily say I know for a fact what his plans are. But another figure that sort of points to this, in addition to the people at HHS, the Larry Ellison statements, the Lutnick statements, is the guy who's slated to be head of the FDA himself. So that's Marty Makary, or Martin Makary, who's a top guy at Johns Hopkins, I believe. And he became a pretty popular recently. He was like on promoted a lot to Trump's base, I think, before he was announced to be FDA head, going on like the Megyn Kelly show. I think he even has his own podcast, but he definitely was a frequent guest on a lot of podcast circuits and, you know, sort of talking about using a lot of the MAHA buzzwords about, you know, chronic health epidemic and all of that. But it's his stance on biotech, I think, has sort of been overlooked by a lot of these influencers in the Make America Healthy Again movement. And I think that was pretty clearly portrayed, not just by the reporting on industry reactions to his appointment as charge of the FDA, but also the boost in stocks for biotech that McCary's announcement elicited. So of course, you know, there have been reports saying every time like a, you know, Kennedy's is advancing toward getting confirmed, there's a dip in vaccine stocks. But the opposite seems to be true for Marty Makary, who has been is considered very friendly to the biotech industry by the people that run that industry, so much to the point that some have said they dodged a bullet with his appointment. Which I think is notable. And as we noted in our article, his statements during COVID-19, he was very unhappy with it taking multiple weeks for the COVID-19 vaccines to be approved under the emergency use paradigm at the FDA. He argued it should have happened in less than 24 hours. So that sort of, you know, combined with how biotech feels about him and that COVID stance under that particular deregulatory paradigm, it seems like he'd be pretty supportive of the vision that people like Jim O'Neill hold. And I don't think I made it explicit earlier, and I probably should have, but Jim O'Neill's interest in eliminating efficacy tests isn't necessarily to eliminate all efficacy data collection. He thinks that data collection should take place after people take the drug and should be conducted via biosurveillance. And as we note in the article, there are a lot of people that he cites as sort of his, I guess, mentors in a sense in developing this view, who argue that that should happen through a variety of means and have a variety of outcomes. I don't know if you'd be interested in speaking to that, Max.
Yeah, for sure. And just one other thing that I think will lead into this stuff about Richard Barker, who I think you're talking about, one of the people that he mentions as being like, I mean, not he doesn't say necessarily that it's like an inspiration, but he talks about how he really appreciates his work and thinks they're doing great stuff on this end of basically deregulation. And but O'Neill's interest, as he notes himself in that talk that where he says that notorious line, well, it was notorious, seems like no one cares anymore, at least in the mainstream media, about eliminating efficacy tests. He's actually been interested in this deregulatory paradigm since his time at HHS, I think, with Tommy Thompson and Mike Leavitt, where he was notably very close in proximity to the centers of power that developed this and initially made a huge step, a significant step towards this deregulatory paradigm. And you talked about creating artificial, like basically manufacturing artificial demand for these markets that no one really wants. O'Neill was arguably, well, I don't want to comment on how crucial of a role he played, but he was certainly very close in proximity to the centers of power at the HHS that were crucial in getting the BARDA passed, the Project BioShield Act of 2004, which implemented or created the BARDA agency. And that then led to them purchasing all of these Tamiflu stockpiles, as you noted in the article, which kind of caused Gilead stock prices to, I think, as you noted, quadruple, right? When it had dipped before.
Well, so BARDA basically functions as like an ATM for big pharma. Any sort of, you know, threat, no matter how manufactured the threat is. And in the case of bird flu, it was mostly manufactured by people who are now very discredited post COVID-19, like Neil Ferguson of the Imperial College of London. A lot of his modeling was used to create these doomsday statistics about what a potential bird flu pandemic would be like, between 2004 and 2006.
Right.
And, he was fresh off the controversy in Britain, where he helped use similar doomsday statistic modeling of dubious credibility as a part of the government response to a mad cow disease outbreak, which led to the unnecessary culling of an insane amount of livestock in Britain and very negatively impacted their farming industry. But basically, you know, as we learned during COVID-19, it's very possible to manufacture fear using statistics and using quote unquote experts in the absence of real clinical data showing the same. And by doing so, you create this threat, and Congress can express outrage, or, you know, the media drums up concern, Congress responds, and BARDA ends up buying a bunch of stockpiles of medication, often billions of dollars worth, from pharmaceutical companies of things that will be used to respond to this doomsday event that doesn't exist yet. And that stockpile, was justified initially by the 2001 anthrax attacks. It was pushed for back as a policy response to that before Project BioShield was even introduced in Congress. This idea that there's going to be bioterror events. I mean, that was back, this is back in the War on Terror era. So that's initially how they sold it, but eventually, moved to the idea of sort of a zoonotic pandemic and needing to sort of stockpile. And so the stockpile since then has sort of been to address both of those threats. And has often been used, by companies of to basically boost companies of dubious credibility, like Emergent BioSolutions, who created the anthrax vaccine that was never properly tested and does not work and has been linked to Gulf War syndrome, among other things, and was actually being given to military personnel and used in an off-label way to the point where they lost in court and had to stop giving it to people until, people like Jerome Hauer came in and saved the day. We can talk about Jerome Hauer another time, but if you're interested in learning more about him and weird things about him and 9/11, you can read my few years old series called Engineering Contagion about those attacks and how a lot of this came to be. But basically, the people that created that infrastructure were also the people that led early COVID response. Like Robert Kadlec, for example, who was Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response under the first Trump administration. He helped author Project BioShield, developed the idea for BARDA. I was very close to the clique that I argue in my series actually committed the 2001 anthrax attacks. There's no way it was actually Bruce Ivins. Anyway, getting a little off topic, but basically, it was basically a way to create welfare for big pharma and to manufacture fear,
right,
for the purpose of basically creating markets for products people don't need or want, and using fear to do so. And also at the same time, it's, a dual use in a way, because fear is also routinely used to take away people's civil liberties. So it's a way to get people to surrender bodily autonomy in one way, and also a way to get civil liberties, as many of them acts as possible for the benefit of the national security state. And I think, COVID-19, years after, BioShield was passed, was definitely quite revealing in how that's how these things tend to work. So, Jim O'Neill's proximity to that, I think, is worth pointing out. And as we note in the article, he was the main speechwriter for Tommy Thompson and Leave It when a lot of this fear mongering about bird flu was going on, and when Project BioShield was being peddled to Congress. And he, you know, notes in his own CV that he was very involved with pandemic response and writing speeches on pandemic influenza, which in this case refers to the bird flu speeches, and then subsequently went on to lead, you know, various, not the same type of role he'll be having now as number two, but definitely a top tier HHS executive level position later on. So he definitely had a lot of clout within the Bush administration's HHS. And it seems like a lot of that deregulatory vision that was, you know, characteristic of the Bush era is likely to make a comeback, even with someone like RFK as the public face of the agency.
Yeah, notably by his own, you know, admission, like he was interested in this deregulation from the beginning, or from his entire, from the beginning of his public sector career, at least. And he was there helping this legislation, presumably helping this legislation get passed on the speechwriting teams of Tommy Thompson and Mike Leavitt. And he actually even brags about in that same talk where he says that we need to eliminate efficacy tests, how he actually blocked the FDA from starting to regulate this one biotechnology. Anyways, yeah. And one thing that the mainstream media reports that talked about that a couple years ago, that speech that he gave where he advocated eliminating efficacy tests, they didn't mention, was that he then goes on to praise the work of this guy named Richard Barker, who's the founding director of CASME, and his model of adaptive licensing. And I think that Barker's model is worth noting because I think it clues us into what O'Neill wants to do, and also this kind of biotech deregulatory slash surveillance paradigm in general.
Really quick, I just want to note for the audience that CASME is housed at Oxford. I believe Barker is British, and the CASME, I believe, is the Center for Accelerating Sustainable Medical Innovation, if I'm not mistaken, which the name should tell you a lot if you're familiar with a PR speak.
Right. So like something that Barker says is that there's this huge problem, I guess, in drug development where basically, and he says it's so severe that it actually is currently, the current way we do drug development is not sustainable. And this issue is that those handling clinical development, so, you know, in my opinion, at least in the way that I think drug development should work, the people that are, you know, in theory, in the best form of capitalism or whatever, should not be concerned with the commercial interests of the drug they're creating, and instead should be concerned with, you know, things like, does it work? Is it going to help save lives or treat people's sicknesses or whatever? He says that they actually need to, that they're too separated from the commercial side, and that they actually need to be, that big pharma and the people that are more concerned with the profits of those drugs need to be infused into the drug development process further. And he says that that should be done via the collection of value data. He basically thinks that this should happen via the utilization and collection of a massive amount of real-world data. And that's data accumulated outside of clinical trial settings, like, you know, through electronic health records, maybe your Apple Watch, your phone, wearables,
and Fitbits. Stuff like that. Yeah.
And then, you know, such, and again, like, this is important to note because regarding the MAHA movement, because RFK Jr.'s agenda is like the exact, I mean, at least the agenda that he was, you know, touting on the campaign trail is like the exact opposite of what this guy Barker says. And, you know, so like, here's a quote that from Barker himself. He says that they need to integrate value in the design of clinical development with an early crafting phase involving the input of regulators, payers, and patient associations, so as to ensure the collection of both clinical and value data. And he literally advocates this as being a way to solve the problem of drug makers having to set the initial market value of their drug as being very high, and instead allow companies to basically like test the value of their drug by through these real world data sources, and then use that data to basically accrue or increase the value of the drug over time, aka basically just like jack up prices of drugs as they exist, as they continue to exist on the market longer by using this what he calls value data, which, you know, for anyone listening would be accumulated from your devices and your labor, whatever, you know, your existence, basically. So like, you know, Barker's literally advocating for big pharma to directly exploit data mined segments of people to cultivate capital and value for drug products with them getting nothing in return. And then, you know, he goes even further where he believes that, patient populations should be segmented and surveilled to basically allow pharma to develop this outcome focused way of creating drugs.
Do you think that could be used potentially for big pharma to like charge different prices for the same drug on different populations? So like if it's deemed to be more effective in one ethnic group than the other, they could charge that ethnic group more than they would charge another ethnic group. Like, is that a potential consequence of this segmented population idea?
Yeah, I mean, I would think so, because I talked to Nolan Higdon, this scholar from, I can't remember what university, but he wrote this book about called Surveillance Education, where he basically studied this data industry, this cloud capital mm-hmm. industry, whatever you want to call it. And he basically said that every time that in his studies that he came across these promises, these altruistic promises where, you know, because Barker's probably thinking that people are going to hear this as, oh, well, that's great. They get to, you know, use my data and then I get a better drug because it's developed for me or something, or my population, people like me. But I mean, he said that in pretty much every case that it's used to exploit the consumer and the worker and jack up prices and cut costs. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that's a possibility or if that happens. I mean, one thing that he said was that it's very likely that these this real world data will also be used by insurance companies, for example, to charge higher premiums based on certain lifestyle habits that these that your wearables or your other devices might pick up on you. So he said, for example, like, oh, you know, you're only sleeping 5 hours a night, and that makes you X amount more likely to get this disease or this condition. Therefore, you're not taking care of yourself, so we can't really cover you because look at this objective data that we have that shows that you're not taking care of yourself. Why would we cover you? So, yeah, I definitely think that's possible.
Well, that's going to be fun for the private insurance companies. They're really going to like that.
Yeah.
They'll be spawning like an army of Luigi Mangionis, I guess.
Yeah. And if O'Neill, you know, seeks to implement Barker's model, they'll even be more involved in the development process. Right. And I'm sure that there's probably concerns that they may already be too involved in that to begin with. And maybe now they'll just be even more involved, which will be great for them. And, you know, in addition, Barker believes that we can have this outcome-focused form of healthcare, like we just mentioned. And basically, he says that we develop in volume currently. So, you know, okay, we got to develop a bunch of this drug and then kind of like hope that people need it and take it. I think an example of that might be the Tamiflu stuff, right? They had this drug, and it seemed like there wasn't so much demand for it. And then they needed to manufacture this artificial demand by instilling fear in the population and selling this pitch about bird flu, et cetera.
Yeah.
So basically, this predictive outcome-focused use of data would allow, quote, products to be prescribed and used by the right patient segments. And then he goes further and he says that we can also use this data that where we segment patients to focus on behavioral factors. So they're also now, they don't just want to cultivate this data for health purposes or for drug development purposes. They also want to produce means of behavioral modification because he says that the industry needs to focus on the behavioral factors which drive adherence either as accelerators or decelerators. So
this sounds so much like the COVID era.
Yeah.
Behavioral modification and nudging and all of that.
Right.
So stop vaccine hesitancy. But I guess now it'll be to stop biosurveillance hesitancy.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing that I think that Matt Half voters are, I mean, everyone, but especially these people that may be optimistic about having RFK Jr. and, you know, some rhetoric about this stuff in the Trump administration. They should be very wary of comments like this because they're actively studying ways to incentivize to make you accept these products. And, you know, so he says the goal should be to collect evidence as to how to boost adherence. And the exercise is complex since there are many types of patients with different behavioral contexts and psychological barriers, which highlights the breadth of data that they're planning to collect on mm-hmm. this issue specifically. And, you know, I noted in the article that this concept of utilizing the these mass data sets to basically manipulate human behavior and direct outcomes of populations is like straight out of the military playbook. I mean, Yasha Levine's book Surveillance Valley is basically about how the entire DARPA tech military apparatus was a counterinsurgency program from the very beginning. And you see that just being repurposed for different means. And the fact that a lot of this data that they want to collect has dual use purposes. So like, for example, the same data that they're collecting on you via your Apple Watch about your health could also presumably be used to predict if you're going to shoot up a school or whatever.
Yeah, because they'll just say it's mental health.
Yeah, exactly. Because I mean, that's the thing. Every time someone does something like that.
Hey, just wait till the Neuralink mandates to make sure everyone is, you know, not secretly thinking about committing crimes before they happen. I say that as a joke, but
Larry Ellison has literally said that when we have this, like these AI nodes all across the country that are constantly analyzing and getting fed this data that, you know, is collected via all these devices that, oh, we're going to be a lot safer because no one's going to misbehave anymore. And right. So, I mean, it's not that far-fetched to think something like that could happen or be pursued or in some capacity. And yeah, so, I mean, I think that that's the gist on Richard Barker. And I think it really clues you into O'Neill's mindset on these things. And also, like, I just wanted to note, too, because, I mean, it appears that they've really banked on exploiting RFK Jr.'s kind of, like, anti-establishment bona fides to sell this stuff. Like, so, for example, here's a tweet from Jim O'Neill where he's advocating this outcome-focused version of drug development. He says, many Americans think we have free markets in healthcare. We don't. Hundreds of bureaucratic rules, perverse incentives, and opaque pricing make healthcare more expensive and less efficient than it should be. Providers of care are usually paid by volume, not outcomes. So he's advocating for outcomes. And then he says this, and to me, this is the co-opting of the RFK, Make America Healthy Again language. He says, and government makes chronic disease worse by subsidizing unhealthy food and offering poor nutritional advice to families who are trying their best to stay healthy. So right there, you have this deregulatory paradigm that conflicts directly with the most, I would say, the most important parts of RFK Jr.'s initial agenda that was associated with the Trump campaign on the campaign trail. You have this language that exploits that radical agenda and associates it with this deregulatory paradigm, which is like super manipulative to people that maybe don't stay up to date on all of this stuff that much and don't have all the time to decipher all these things.
Or don't follow what people linked to Peter Thiel do and say. Yeah. You know? Yeah, interesting. Where they talk about both sides of their mouth. Yeah, that's interesting. So I also think it's worth pointing out, too, that before we kind of wrap up the discussion on O'Neill here, you know, a lot of his affiliation with Thiel, it's very extensive. We noted in the piece, but also, you know, for a lot of his O'Neill's, you know, after he was out of government and also no longer working for a Thiel affiliated VC, he was working for the SENS Research Foundation, which is devoted to like treating longevity related or like age related diseases. It's basically, I would argue, one of those sort of Silicon Valley health quote unquote foundations that aims to offer life extension technologies. And, you know, a lot of big tech bros are kind of obsessed with this idea of immortality. Probably the most infamous of those is Brian Johnson. And he, along with Peter Thiel, have a significant interest in injecting young people's blood into themselves to stay young, for example. It's true. And the SENS Research Foundation is focused on, using biotech, including mRNA, DNA vaccines, And, you know, technology like that in order to allegedly extend people's lifespans, which is the SENS Research Foundation is also, you know, really exists thanks to the financing of Thiel as well. Mm-hmm. So it's no surprise that you have a lot of people affiliated with Thiel present there, like O'Neill, also Blake Masters, who's sort of like a J.D. Vance type of Thiel creation, whose failed political career was also bankrolled by Thiel. And he was on the SENS Research Foundation with O'Neill for some time. And they're focused on a lot of that kind of angle of biotech as well. And I think it's fair to sort of look. I mean, people need to pay attention to a lot of the Silicon Valley big tech and big pharma overlap. You know, I've been covering it a lot since the COVID era. But basically, there's been this effort, and you covered it in your piece about the WHO and permanent pandemic markets, this idea of the traditional income model for big pharma has basically run out of steam. It's been telegraphed openly by big pharma itself. They refer to it as the patent cliff issue. And so the way they want to get around patent cliffs, which is basically related to how products go generic and they don't make as much money when they're not exclusive products of that pharmaceutical company anymore. They've been going into biotech, and a lot of that is through joint ventures with big tech companies like Google, for example. And, you know, a lot of those companies also now double as major and essential parts of the national security state and national security state contractors and integral parts of the national security, mass surveillance apparatus. And so the idea of having a lot of this, you know, this idea of selling biosurveillance and all of this is a way to improve, you know, market response to healthcare products and all of this stuff, I would argue is really kind of a sly way to manufacture what I think is pretty openly acknowledged as the final frontier of mass surveillance, which is surveilling people's bodies through wearables and eventually through things inside the body, nanomedicines. And of course, I would put brain computer interfaces, BCIs like Neuralink in that category. And I think it's important to remember too, with brain machine interfaces or BCIs, that it ultimately comes to the FDA to approve them. FDA tends to grant them breakthrough device status, which sort of waives some of the quote unquote regulatory red tape for these things. But we have, you know, Elon Musk having a very prominent role in the government. Right now, he doesn't have to divest from any of his companies at all in that role. And neither does another PayPal mafia figure who's also now a special government employee, David Sacks, the crypto AI czar. And as crypto AI czar, it's very possible he could partner with someone like O'Neill, who is also a very big advocate for AI and healthcare, and see some of the stuff expanded as well. And I would definitely encourage people to pay attention to how this could potentially advance, because it has very Orwellian possibilities if they are collecting not just our data from our external activities and our external environment. There's this really crazy push to surveil everything and sort of mine all the data possible. You have companies tied to the current administration, for example, creating the Internet of Forests, trying to hook up every tree in the Amazon rainforest to mine biodata out of rainforest trees. It sounds bonkers, but there's ambitions to do that to people as well and create the so-called Internet of Bodies, which military contractors and think tanks like the RAND Corporation have been writing about for years. And it's really not. I mean, I think Purdue or some other university like that recently created a whole center dedicated to accelerating the development of the Internet of Bodies. Silicon Valley has been pushing the wearable agenda for some time, and I think we could potentially see the push for that come through, you know, under the guise of health. You know, initially it was like, look how cool Google glasses are, and look at my VR Apple helmet. And now I guess Facebook has made these like Ray-Ban looking ones that they think will not look as insane on people.
Yeah, my friend has a pair, and they look completely stupid.
Yeah, you should break them for him. be like, hey, did you know Facebook started as a DARPA project? Can I borrow those for a second and take them to the garage? I don't know. Sorry. getting a little too opinionated there. But anyway, this really is an ambition of that. And I think, you know, when you have someone like Larry Ellison of Oracle, who was previously contracted to biosurveil COVID-19 vaccine recipients, coming out and saying, we're going to have all these AI personalized cancer vaccines. They're going to be personalized. They're going to have to gather the testing data on you after you receive them. And they may not do the same method they did with COVID-19 with like blanket mandates, but it's very possible there will be some other type of coercive measure to try and get people to adopt this. Because a big theme, whether it's healthcare or really anything else, like I mentioned earlier in reference to the SDGs, is about creating new markets that will make, you know, this oligarch class very wealthy and entrench their power and sort of lead to this neo-feudalism in society. And I think this is one of those, you know, ways they could do that, because the only way they can get people to want these products is to create, you know, use public policy as the enabling environment for these markets, essentially. So it's kind of crazy, honestly, to see a lot of the mental gymnastics that have been used to sort of explain away the Stargate announcement or Lutnick's comment about buying the U.S. government now buying equity in COVID-19 mRNA vaccine companies or any of the other things we've discussed today. Even when our article came out on Jim O'Neill and his potential to undermine, you know, a lot of these early MAHA ambitions, you know, pretty much crickets from a lot of the big influencers in that movement, which honestly, you know, is kind of telling in itself as well. But also just a very little interest in addressing Palantir really at all. And Palantir, of course, is a company that has expanded under every administration. It's a bipartisan, you know, it's the engine on which the quote unquote deep state runs. But yet no one in this administration or, you know, its supporters really wants to talk about Palantir really very much at all. And how many investors in Palantir, O'Neill included, but also, you know, people like Joe Lonsdale was a major donor to Trump. David Sachs is also an investor in Palantir. He's the crypto AI czar. And of course, Peter Thiel co-founded Palantir. And Palantir has played has numerous contracts with the U.S. military and other, you know, all of every 18 intelligence, all 18 of the U.S. intelligence agencies, also very involved in Ukraine. Which Kennedy was a big critic of, as well as the genocide in Gaza, which RFK, of course, is not a critic of. But nevertheless, Palantir has become kind of ubiquitous today. They also run a lot of the data for the British NHS, National Health Service, and they also run it for HHS, which I know you covered recently on your piece about the Palantir-run Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analysis at the CDC. And I think that's worth covering a little bit here too, as we try and wrap up here, to talk about sort of how, you know, a new paradigm, if there's a new quote unquote public health emergency, how lockdowns or any of these other measures that became infamous during COVID might be implemented quote unquote more gently as a way to make people think that, you know, there's been an improvement over past, you know, after post COVID, when in reality, a lot of these same tactics that are sort of very probable in a future pandemic scenario were really tested out during COVID to a significant extent.
Yeah. And just like, I'll get into the bigger picture CFA, Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics, the Palantir run CDC program you just mentioned in a second, the bigger picture stuff. But just like regarding that comment you made about nano chips, I think, and Musk Neuralink. A lot of times when I bring that up to people, I think they kind of roll their eyes and they're like, this sounds ridiculous. Like, this is sci-fi at this point. But like, so just for example, the Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics, they have this thing called the Innovate branch. And that's responsible for collaborating with, quote, academic, private sector, and interagency partners as part of its goal to create products, tools, and enterprise enhancements in order to make pandemic data analysis flexible, fast, and scalable for CFA customers, including state, tribal, local authorities. And right now, you know, take note of that line where it says that they're working with interagency partners to create products and tools and enterprise enhancements to make this data sharing more vast and flexible. We noted in our article on Jim O'Neill that ARPA-H, that program that we mentioned earlier that was initially a pre-crime program, is actually creating a device. They commissioned four different teams to develop bioelectronic devices to be implanted in patients through minor outpatient surgery. So that's literally from the ARPA-H website. That's not me talking, that's them.
Yeah.
And one team is aiming to create a living sentinel, is what they call it, to measure key biomarkers in the body and monitor their bodily conditions in real time. And then all of the teams are aiming to develop an implantable living pharmacy programmed to deliver therapeutic molecules to the patient on demand for an extended period. So,
okay, great.
Yeah. Right there. So right there, you have this thing that's going to, I guess, automatically feed you these therapeutic, you know, maybe even...
They're therapeutic. Don't ask what the molecules are. It's therapeutic. It's like going to the spa.
Yeah, exactly, right? And it's made just for you, right? Because now they have this thing to constantly collect data from...
They got a lot of people's DNA through COVID vaccine testing, and Palantir took all of that data.
Right. And now they want to get more of it, I guess, because they want to create a living sentinel to constantly analyze your genealogy.
They want to mine people constantly for bio data and have the AI constantly awash in data that our bodies generate, because data is the new oil. So you have to tap every possible source you can for data. And the best way to generate data is to continually extract it from something that's alive. So that's why I think, you know, we're having a lot of this push into Internet of Bodies, the Internet of Forests, and all of these things, because the parameters of a living thing are constantly in flux, right? Because it's alive, it's not inert. And so you can generate a lot of data and have, I mean, the more successful your AI will become is determined by how much data it's feeding on and also the quality of that data, right? So I think that's one of the incentives here. And again, I think people might sort of be ignoring brain-machine interfaces at their own risk, because there are a considerable amount of ties to that industry from this administration. So again, I mean, obviously Elon Musk is probably the most obvious because of Neuralink. Which has had a lot of controversies over the amount of animals that died during their animal trials, for example. If the FDA under Trump is very amenable to BCIs, we could see them potentially commercialized over the next 4 years. Because again, that's something, those are devices that have to undergo FDA approval in order to go on the market. But there's several companies that are farther along than Neuralink are. One of those is BlackRock Neurotech, which recently received a very significant investment from the stablecoin issuer Tether, which has a lot of ties to Howard Lutnick, the Secretary of Commerce. And Tether, of course, is also very much connected to Rumble. Rumble, of course, also tied to Howard Lutnick, also tied to J.D. Vance, the vice president, and Peter Thiel. And their general counsel just became the number two guy at the CIA, Michael Ellis. And then they're also connected to Tether, also invested really heavily in this firm called Satellogic, which is a satellite surveillance company that's involved in, they're building the Internet of Forests, for example, for the purpose of turning each hectare of the Amazon into basically like a token that you can buy. It sounds totally insane, but it's true.
And Satellogic is also kind of connected. It's directly connected to Palantir because they have a 5-year partnership, right?
Yes. They're contracting with Palantir right now. And Lutnick is on the board of that one. And Steve Mnuchin, who was Treasury Secretary during Trump's first term, is the chairman of the board. So it's interesting that you have people like Musk doing sort of this satellite digital finance and brain chip play, and you have Tether basically replicating that play. And they both have significant ties to the government, and they would, a lot of the companies in that web need government approval in order to get their products on the market. I don't know. That seems like a disturbing setup for internet of bodies stuff going forward. And I think there's going to be a lot of different ways this stuff is sold to a reluctant audience, which would be Trump's base, I think, but probably not exclusively Trump's base. I think there's plenty of people on the left that are not really interested in this stuff either. But though I've already sort of seen people sort of in the Trump supporting sphere say things like mRNA is fine as long as there's no mandates, and sort of kind of changing the realm of discussion a little bit. Already, or we can't hinder innovation. And a lot of the, of course, celebrity worship of people like Elon, I think, you know, you've had, there's people like Tim Pool that have tweeted very supportively of Neuralink press releases being like, Neuralink, let's go. So, I mean, it's very possible we could see more of that. And then, I don't know. I don't know exactly how they're going to get people to use that stuff, but I think they won't have any problem getting it through FDA approval under this administration.
Yeah, I mean, like, it seems like the go-to strategy for, you know, big capital or big business is basically, I mean, it's the national security strategy. It's the creating these phantom enemies. I'm reading this book right now called Drug Cartels Do Not Exist by Oswald. I don't remember the author's name, actually, but he talks about the creation of a phantom enemy or something, basically this ever-changing thing. That, and I mean,
invisible enemies.
Yeah. Yeah. And basically that seems to be the strategy for kind of everything that they want to do that would normally be met with skepticism by the public. And it kind of tends to work. I mean, like, you know, when the internet was first coming out, it was recognized as a tool of surveillance by the military industrial complex. And there was actually a lot of resistance that the military met when they were trying to utilize universities like MIT and other places to develop this stuff by the student body that was, you know, kind of radical and anti-war at the time. And now it's, you know, no one really cares. I was telling my friends about this Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics piece that I wrote for your website for Unlimited Hangout. And, you know, I told them, oh, well, it's this thing where there's this apparatus between big healthcare and Silicon Valley, and they're trying to predict disease outbreaks before they occur so that they can develop procured policy that's specified at certain communities to lock them down. And then my friend said, isn't that a good thing? And I was like, well,
they'll sell it as a good thing. They'll be like, well, here we go. We don't have to lock down the whole country. We only have to lock down the areas that need to be locked down.
Right, exactly. And then that's the pitch, I guess, for kind of everyone, but specifically at those like people that were skeptical of the more universal style non-pharmaceutical intervention policies during COVID-19. Well, oh, now it's more objective and it's just the people that need to get shut down, right? But the thing that I think is really important worth noting regarding the Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics and Palantir's role in it, basically the Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics seems to be the office that is dedicated to carrying out what the CDC calls its common operating picture, where they want to create this consortium of academic, private sector, and interagency partners dedicated to constantly analyzing and collecting bio data to predict pandemic outbreaks and correspondingly prepare and respond for them when they happen or may happen. And the Center for Forecasting and that strategy of doing that actually comes out from the Total Information Awareness Program, which you've covered extensively. You can probably get into
probably too much. Yes.
Yeah. And that's important because the Total Information Awareness Program at its core was a pre-crime program. And it sought to use it to tap things like financial records. And I mean, at the time,
everything. Everything about you.
Everything. Mm-hmm. Everything that was available at the
total. They really meant it.
Yeah. At the time, I don't think that they really had Apple Watches and Fitbits and iPhones.
They wanted them, and they got them now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to stop terrorism before it happened. And I mean, you could see that, like, if you go back, I can't think of.
But these ideas are not old. When Trump was in office the last time, he called on Silicon Valley to develop software to detect mass shooters before they strike. And then you had the HARPA program that his administration was considering, basically offering to do that by running, you know, a social media post through AI to determine which Americans show early warning signs of neuropsychiatric violence, which probably would be literally everyone on Twitter. But, you know.
Yeah. And then Peter Thiel with that company, I can't remember his exact involvement. I think he's an investor in it, or it was a seed funder or something. Clearview AI actually scanned.
Main investor.
Mm-hmm. Right. Main investor actually did that exact strategy, you know, scouring social media, I think via AI to track down people that were at the January 6th protests and arrest them. And a lot of those people were, you know, like, I mean, there's still a lot that are awaiting trial, I think. Well, I think Trump just pardoned them, actually, but up until recently, at least.
Well, they bragged about using facial recognition to have those people arrested by law enforcement.
Yeah, right.
And so that's what people don't realize, is that this is really an outgrowth of the war on domestic terror. There were explicit efforts said by Bill Gates, but also maybe tech billionaires you don't hate, about combining national security with health security. And that is why Palantir is running it for the national security state, and they're also running it for HHS. The goal is to fuse those two things into one thing. And the way they'll probably do it, or the easiest way for them to manufacture consent for that, is what they tried to do with the 2001 anthrax attacks and talk about bioterror. And, you know, there was sort of efforts to seed these kind of narratives in early COVID-19. Neo-Nazis are licking doorknobs and giving people COVID. That was literally like stories that happened. Those were real stories used to sort of fearmonger this type of stuff. And I think, you know, they may try and, you know, they're not a creative bunch. They like to recycle a lot of their narratives and their old playbooks. Look no further than the Sean Ryan show for proof of that. But I think people should be very cognizant of this stuff, because it's going to be framed as a win. They will say, oh, we only have to lock down this community and that community and not the whole country. And people that criticize the COVID response, I'm sure many of them will applaud it. But the problem is, this was actually tested out during COVID-19 itself, basically the Israeli equivalent of Palantir as it relates to COVID-19 response. And I say that in the context of Palantir's contract with Operation Warp Speed. But the Israeli equivalent of that in the COVID-19 era was this firm called Diagnostic Robotics. And they were given a contract to basically predict COVID outbreaks in Rhode Island before they happen by then governor of Rhode Island, Gina Raimondo, who later became Biden's commerce secretary. And this firm, if you believe their own numbers that they put out in like their PR leaflets and stuff, say that their algorithm is 75% accurate, and that's not audited. So we could assume that it's probably lower than what they publicly profess in their sales pitch. So maybe it's 60%, maybe it's 50%. I don't know, but that's getting dangerously close. Or in the case of 50%, literally is the same as a coin toss.
Right.
So you're deciding to either shut down entire local economies based on an algorithm that is not 100% accurate. So I would argue that isn't better. You're still taking away people's civil liberties based on faulty data. And if it's about, you know, using AI algorithms that aren't accurate either, or notoriously racially biased, to be like, this ethnic minority needs the shot and this one doesn't, which is exactly what Palantir did under Operation Warp Speed. That's what their Tiberius program literally was about. You know, it definitely becomes very Orwellian. And so maybe it's not collective punishment, maybe in the same way as during the COVID-19 era. But this is ultimately this idea of sort of personalizing things, whether it's personalized COVID vaccines or personalized, localized pandemic response. This was the goal. And a lot of this stuff, as I noted during the COVID era, you know, the antecedents of it were all sort of dreamt up and first attempted, you know, in the immediate post 9/11 era. I don't know. It seems like a lot of those programs have not gone away. And actually, you know, a lot of the total information awareness programs, they were specifically called bio surveillance. And some of them included, surveilling wastewater to prevent disease before it happens. And that was literally a program that was launched during COVID and that Palantir runs. And I've argued in my work that Palantir is just the privatized version of Total Information Awareness, because Peter Thiel and Alex Karp went to the guy running Total Information Awareness and were basically like, tell us what to do because we want to make this a private company now that you're being defunded by Congress, and then get all this money from the CIA and the top people at the CIA that were working on Total Information Awareness with the DARPA people and John Poindexter become the main funders of Palantir with Peter Thiel. I mean, I don't know. But I should say in the context of the PayPal presidency theme that Palantir itself started off as the anti-fraud algorithm at PayPal, and PayPal itself as a company started as a consequence of its founders having extensive conversations with every three-letter agency that would talk to them. That's according to PayPal co-founder Max Levchin, so who gave a spirited defense of NSA warrantless spying in the Snowden era. So much for that whole libertarian veneer of the PayPal crowd, but it's fine.
And, you know, like you're talking about these models that are going to be dictating curated policy for at least communities, maybe individuals. One of the things that the Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics plans to do with this biodata is use it to dictate the community migration rights of communities. So basically like where you can go and enter, I'm presuming they don't specify exactly.
Yeah, the whole, oh no, that sounds a lot like what Trump supporters were calling 15-minute cities not that long ago.
Right, yeah.
Hey, but it's our elites that are running it, Max.
Yeah.
Our elites are going to run it.
Yeah. Barry Weiss did an episode with
Peter Thiel.
And she was and I forgot exactly what it
the
was.
The counter elites.
Like the counter,
turn. Yes, they're so different.
Yeah, evidenced by Elon Musk taking over, I can't remember the name of the government department, and then actually talking with Google, DeepMind AI, to basically take over, to start helping dictate which departments to cut and everything. So they're totally different, all these people. And, you know, like, regarding like this inaccuracy that these hallucinations, I guess, that you could call the AI experiences where they aren't correct a lot of the time. I mean, just for example, how like even these chat bot ones are pretty inaccurate, or are actually super inaccurate every time I've used them. You know, if even if the chat bots are inaccurate, I can't imagine how the disease forecasting ones are. But
they don't need to be accurate. I mean, it's an industry with a lot of overhype issues. And a lot of these companies that are the biggest AI companies, especially when it's like legacy big tech companies making them, like Google or Oracle or whatever, a lot of them have very deep national security connections from their origins on and are arguably fronts for those agencies. At which point you have to, you know, they only really need the perception that the algorithm is accurate anyway. And I don't think, a lot of what you brought up earlier about like Ellison saying AI surveillance systems will have people be on their best behavior. The whole idea of the panopticon and all of that is the idea that, you know, you're being watched constantly, but you don't know if you're being watched. So that induces obedience and quote unquote correct behavior. And so, you know, they could, you know, the idea that the algorithm is monitoring these things, even if it's not accurate, it can still, you know, have a lot of the same consequences as long as people think it's accurate. And I think there's a lot of perception manipulation. I think that's pretty clear for the public. And a lot of it is trying to manage how the public feels about it. And having these sort of AI surveillance systems is meant to sort of have that kind of panopticon effect. I think, I don't think they're really in these applications really meant to work very much, you know.
Yeah.
As an example, you know, like law enforcement use of AI. In Britain, the Met Police had a contract with, I forget what company, but it was found to be notoriously inaccurate. They were using it for live facial recognitions of all sorts of public events in the UK. And it came out that it was like dismally, its accuracy was just dismal. And they made no effort to correct or change vendors. Why would that be? Because they don't care.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, because if they did care, they would obviously change vendors. There's no shortage of people selling that particular product. But the idea is that there's, you know, they're being watched. But it's important to point out, too, that they're also very racially biased, which, you know, has, you know, I argued in my work in the COVID era, there was a lot of eugenics era people that have rebranded. Bill Gates became kind of infamous as a figure pushing policies analogous to that. And, you know, I think people should be pretty wary of that, especially when Palantir's evolved because of its history of racial bias and things like pre-crime, which they call predictive policing, and also in warp speed. And also people like Peter Thiel and Alex Karp's like complete obsession with race stuff. Like Alex Karp is like convinced that like white Americans are going to push him out of a high rise building because he's half black and half Jewish. And he's like, I'm amazed I haven't been murdered by a different race yet. I don't think that sounds like a sane person that I want having this much power over our surveillance state and healthcare data. And that's going to have the power to segment populations and decide what, quote unquote, medical interventions they're prescribed by the state in some sort of national level health event or whatever. That's, I mean, it's just, it's bonkers. Man, I feel like I'm ranting here, though. I mean, there's so much we could cover, and I think we're getting close to the time we usually wrap this podcast up. But is there anything else you'd like to note on any of these fronts, or any points or further reading you might want to recommend to viewers?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that people should. I don't know if they could. Where they could get it, because I'm a Unlimited Hangout premium member, so I got it. But the Solari Report, AI Revolution, Final Coup d'Etat by You. I think that that is really interesting regarding this stuff that we're talking about, the bigger picture elements and the way that it's going to be sold to us versus the way that it actually works. Because I mean, you talk about how AI, I mean, you just give perfect example of how AI has these hallucinations, insane inaccuracies. In my own experience, I've in my limited experience using these things, I remember I talked to some friends and they're saying, oh my God, ChatGPT is amazing. You can ask it anything and it gets it right every time. And I said, are you serious? Every time I've asked it something and I've fact checked it, it gets it wrong almost every single time. Like, for example, the other day I saw that Trump's new press secretary is named Caroline Leavitt. I was like, huh, I wonder if she's related to Mike Leavitt. So I asked ChatGPT just to see what it would say. And it was like, yes. Mike Leavitt is Caroline Leavitt's father. I looked it up. No, that's not true. I said, that's not true. Oh, sorry. It's actually his niece. That's not true either. Oh, they're actually cousins. Not true. So you got it like wrong like five times in a row on this basic question.
Yeah. Well, I think there are things that AI can probably do effectively. I've heard from people that it's quite good at coding, for example, and some other things. But obviously the code that it makes has to go back and be checked and audited like by a human and stuff. I don't know. I personally am. Well, I'm not a big AI evangelist, quite the opposite as people who follow my work closely would know. But I think the point here, whether you're an advocate or sort of a skeptic, is that a lot of the applications it's being pitched for at the law enforcement, national security level, and also in healthcare, the accuracy matters a lot there, especially because there's, you know, if they don't really necessarily give it human oversight, which in a lot of these cases, it's pretty minimal, I think. And as we're moving into the world of autonomous warfare and autonomous everything will probably become, you know, less human oversight as time goes on. I think people should be, you know, very wary of that and know that accuracy matters. And one thing I do want to add before we wrap up here, as it relates to mRNA stuff likely coming on the market in significant numbers over the next 4 years, if people want to push for something at the policy level that may actually end up happening, have products with mRNA in it be labeled, whether that's, you know, meat that was injected, the animal was injected with mRNA while it was alive, like in the food supply or in the pharmaceutical system. I think people have a right to know. And so, you know, if we can't necessarily, you know, trust that it'll be kept the market, even with RFK in charge of HHS or something like that, I think there should be I think it would be kind of practical to push to have informed consent at the very least about what products have mRNA or genetic material and which ones do not.
Yeah. And RFK is actually one of his things that he's been pushing, I think more lately, has been this right to know thing. So if the Trump campaign really, or the Trump administration really does support RFK, then that shouldn't be a problem. But I kind of doubt it.
Well, but, we'll see.
Yeah, I kind of doubt it. But I don't have much else to say. All I'll say is, because I don't think we got the comments super in depth on the Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics, but I would say the big picture read of that is that it's the resurrection of the biosurveillance elements of total information awareness and the entrenchment of it into a full center dedicated to carrying out this kind of biosurveillance to predict pandemics constantly. The entrenchment of that into our current public health agency and private academic apparatus. It's really resurrecting that and implementing it. And I think we'll see a concrete way eventually. And the reason that that's important, it's pairing with total information awareness, is because the data that it taps is dual use, like so much of this stuff. Like you just mentioned how AI might be useful for some things, that might be true, but you have to look at the interest of the people that are implementing it and what they actually want to do and what their incentives are and ideologies are. And it just so happens that this biosurveillance data is just as useful for pre-crime purposes, which as you mentioned, Palantir and Alex Karp and Peter Thiel just privatized as soon as Congress killed it. And so that's something to be wary of for anyone that might see this predictive health stuff as beneficial, because I understand why it's enticing. Like I know someone that has an Apple Watch and their heart slowed down and it automatically called an ambulance for them. And they said that their Apple Watch saved their life, right? I see why it's enticing, but those dual use elements that are very apparent if you look at the origins and the people involved have to be considered. So that's all I'd say.
Great. Well, I think those are great points to add. And I would also add too that, you know, total information awareness needs to be seen for what it is. It is a neocon program that has been rebranded. This is like a neoconservative agenda that really goes back to the Reagan era, in terms of the idea of using, you know, this type of surveillance and a lot of it, including the person that, you know, ran total information awareness and is considered the godfather of modern surveillance, John Poindexter. He was one of the highest ranking member of the Reagan administration to be indicted as part of Iran-Contra. And Iran-Contra was trying to develop a similar surveillance program for the purpose of clamping down on domestic dissent in the event of a vaguely defined national emergency. And in the power of the state, this is not good. The government has misused this kind of power and this kind of data many times. To quote a former NSA and CIA director, Michael Hayden, we kill people with metadata. People need to be very careful about what kind of data you're willingly going to surrender over to the government. And when you're allowing them, you know, insight into what your internal body is doing, and also in the case of your of the brain chip, what you're thinking. And it doesn't even have to go as far as a brain chip anymore, if you believe any of the some of the sales pitches of technology currently being touted. But I think we need to be really aware and cognizant. And for people that want to know the risks of this, actually a big tech beloved futurist, Yuval Noah Harari, made it quite clear how this could easily lead to the end, what he calls the end of free will and authoritarianism. That's just completely unprecedented, where the state can know, even if you're externally expressing one reaction to a policy or a politician, if you're internally showing a negative response, they can, as he says, send you to the gulag the next morning. That doesn't really sound very appealing to me, and not that it would happen overnight, but if we continue to be sort of coaxed into this complacency that all these big tech bros with ties to the national security state have our best interests at heart, when they're actually, sort of implementing these, this kind of overtly neoconservative agenda, I think there are definite dangers that come with that. So, Max, where can people follow your work?
Yeah, so I have a Twitter, which I sometimes tweet from. It's at Maxy Jones. So that's spelled Max, M-A-X-Y-Y, Jones, J-O-N-E-S. And I also have a Substack that I don't really use that much, but I'm planning to use it more, called antijones.substack.com, I think, hopefully. Yeah, okay, that's what it's called. So I'm going to start writing on that more soon. And then, of course, you can check out my articles at Unlimited Hangout.
Thanks very much for your insights and reporting, Max, and really enjoyed having you on the podcast. Love to have you back on again sometime. And thanks to everyone for listening, especially those who support this podcast. And we'll catch you all in the next episode. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Wendy.